everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters. I am your host, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. I'm very excited to bring another extraordinary guest to the table, Dr. Regina Davis Moss. I am such a fan. I want to say when I got a chance to meet you in person, it was such a pleasure, and I feel like the universe wanted us to meet, and we had such a lovely time connecting at the roundtable discussion, and I found out all of these new terms that I didn't know about, like reproductive justice, and what does that mean, and how we can really strive to protect maternal rights. And given our current climate and sort of our times of uncertainty, I thought it would be wonderful to have you on and to talk a little bit about your journey and how you started doing this work. And then also about your book, which is something that I really wanted to chat about as well. So Dr. Davis Moss, if you could tell us just a small snippet of your current role, and then how'd you get there?
Well, first of all, let me just say thanks for having me. Yes, it was such, you know, we met and then we met over this weekend, and then we just kept running into each other at different events, which meant we definitely, it was just a matter of time. I'm sure that our paths have crossed probably before that time, and we just hadn't known each other because we both care about the same things and are trying to champion the same issues. So I'm president and CEO of In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda, and the In Our Own Voice Action Fund, which is our 501c4 sister organization that basically means that we can, when we're doing that policy advocacy work that we do from day to day, we can push a little bit harder in terms of centering candidates that commit to champion reproductive justice, but also in times like we just had in the election, you know, helping to lift up those candidates, as well as standing in solidarity with other organizations that are doing this work. I said a term called reproductive justice, and I never like to assume people know what that is. It was founded 30 years ago by 12 Black women who attended a conference. And conference was very much like this time. They were exploring things, looking at things like our healthcare system. And there were a lot of women in the room, a lot of white feminists to be exact, who really kept bringing the conversation back to reproductive rights. And there were 12 Black women at this conference, only 12, who looked around at each other. Some of them knew each other, some knew one another, but some of them did not. And said, you know what, this is not right. Right? How do we have a conversation about healthcare and not really center reproductive healthcare holistically, but to only talk about it in a concept of having access to abortion? So if you remember around 30 years ago, there were a lot of things happening to Black women. We were talking about things like HIV/AIDS and STIs and infant mortality and teen pregnancy. And, you know, if you were seeking public support in terms of public assistance, you know, there were requirements like you had to take long acting, you know, contraceptions. And, you know, so we were not just concerned about not getting pregnant. We wanted to get pregnant. And we also wanted, you know, to talk about the other things that impact our decisions when we decide whether or not, you know, if we find ourselves faced with that question about this is an unintended pregnancy, there's a lot of things we have to ask ourselves. And we wanted to talk about things like, you know, that has to do with, can I keep my job? Can I stay in school? Is this going to increase my risk for maternal mortality? Or is this going to be a risk to my infant? And a lot of other questions. And so we said, you know what, if you're going to have this conversation, we need to make sure it's a broader, more expansive conversation, like our neighborhoods, what happens after we have these children. You know, our kids, children are subject to over-policing, our sons. Our daughters are in schools and they are being, the disciplinary practices, there's a bias there. They're pushed, a lot of times what our daughters cannot get away with, a lot of things their white classmates can get away with. So it was really these 12 women that stood together in intentional solidarity and said, we want to make sure that this conversation just doesn't stop with abortion rights, which we just saw most recently that was centered around. And we were out there saying the same thing. So reproductive justice, in short, is the right to decide when and how we expand our families, if we want families, the right to raise those families in safe and sustainable environments, and the right to sexual expression. Because, just because we are, like I talked about, if we want to have children, right? But we believe that your sexual expression and the ways that however you do express yourself sexually, whether that be through your gender identity, your sexual orientation, that should not be associated with your womb, right? A lot of the conversations we have are very womb-centric and very much focused on whether or not you should or should not reproduce. And they're actually not. Your sexuality is a continuum. So that's what I do, in a short way. But I will tell you what I love most about my job is that I do that 24/7, and I focus only on Black women, girls, and gender expansive people. I do that 24/7. I do that every year. Obviously, it was a lot of conversation about this in this current election cycle, but I'm working on that. I'll be working on it next year, and I'll be working on it, until we get to our larger vision, which is, the right, honestly, to have access to the resources and the opportunities that we need to be able to thrive, but also to have the social and economic and political power so that we ultimately have liberation.
Yeah. And I know you've been in this role since 2023, and there was just, with the Dobbs decision and a lot of different moving parts as far as, the policy side, right? So I think, when we talk about justice, we think, okay, there's got to be something in there around equity, but ultimately it's choice, which is what you were describing. And sometimes we don't have a choice because the choice was made for us, because unfortunately, a lot of these very draconian policies are made by folks that don't have wombs. Let's be honest. And so as someone who is very close to this, I've had two children. Both times I had complications. The second time, after the birth of my youngest child, I had birth-related complications and a birth-related trauma and was denied care. And so I'm very open about that. And the fact that even as a healthcare professional, even with someone with a doctorate, I still face the same challenges that other Black women do. And actually, if you look at the statistics, and I know you know this very well, education isn't even a factor. So it doesn't matter if you are highly educated or not, when you walk into that ER, if you walk into that provider's office, all they see is a Black woman, they don't see anything else. And so you're still treated, unfortunately, based on the fact that modern obstetrician and gynecology is based off of experimentation and torture of enslaved women from Dr. Sims and in internalized structural racism within our healthcare system.
Yeah, I mean, you said it, and I, you know what, I'm hate that we're both in the same club. I also had a traumatic birth experience. My son was in the NICU. My blood pressure spiked. We are, as you said, we totally dispel that myth that this is only happening to, this is related to socioeconomic status. It's not, right? Because when we look at the data, we see that Black women with not just bachelor's degrees, undergraduate degrees, but also secondary degrees, MBAs, doctors, lawyers have worse health outcomes, birth outcomes than white women that do not even graduate from high school. right? So that tells you that there is something in this system. We've done, we're both public health folks, so I know, we love the data, right? So we've seen, right, if we get us if Black women are in prenatal care early, if we do all these things that, when we take these holistic public health approaches should theoretically work, we still see these disparities. So that lets you know that there's something outside of the individual interventions that we have to do. And even when we look at now, right? So the maternal mortality, large percentage of them are happening post, they're postpartum. When we look at the causes, they're largely over, three quarters of them are preventable. And so that says if we know when it's happening and we know that they're preventable, why are we not stepping in like we need to? So then we start looking at the political will and what's happening in our system, and all these other things that largely what we would say are directly related to our bodily autonomy. And that's what, I'm glad you mentioned this, this is what we have found, right? Even in this conversation that we were having around access to abortion, we are one of the few organizations that actually, when you hear in the news, we hear a lot of polls and they say, Black women felt this way, Black women felt that way. Well, we actually talk to them because, and that's why we were founded, because we were tired of having other people speak for us. We were tired of being on the defensive. That's why we're called In Our Own Voice. So every year we do a poll where we ask questions like this. We ask questions like, what is the priority to you? What's more, what are issues that are, top of mind for you? What is going to cause you to turn out to vote, or what's going to make you less likely to vote? And when we ask this question time and time again for the last 10 years, they will say, my number one issue is the economy. My second is, free and fair democracy, racial justice. And then in the top five, we do see abortion, right? Because to be clear, when we look at who's being criminalized, it's Black women. When you're those women that are in the parking lot or going into the emergency room because they've unfortunately experienced a miscarriage and they're being handcuffed, right? So of course it's an issue for us. And when we look at how Dobbs has impacted Black women, Dobbs is being the time when Roe v. Wade was struck down. We asked that question, and almost 60% of Black women who are in reproductive age that live in the states where there are abortion bans have said that Dobbs has really made them very scared, made them think about, not even having kids anymore, moving to different states, their increased risk of maternal mortality, just overall feeling less safe. So, there's so many things that we're trying to uplift when we talk about this issue. And, Audre Lorde said this best when she said, we do not live single issue lives, right? There's no way that a Black woman can just focus on one issue when there's so many other pressing issues. And so that's what we try to do, is just lift up all those other issues that are just as important.
Yeah, that reminds me of when we were, when we met at that reception at the NAACP, we had the Kimberly Crenshaw there, and what that was reminding me when you said that just now about intersectionality and how we are so, we're more than just a monolith. There's so many different factors, and again, that intersectionality of like, how are we, how are we being portrayed, not just by policymakers, but how are we being portrayed in the media? I think a lot of what we see, and unfortunately, a lot of the misconception around this is because of the fact that we have, been portrayed in the media as low income, getting access to public assistance, having multiple children, having different fathers, like all of these things. And it's like that's in the social consciousness. And then when you really come down to it, has nothing to do with any of that. Like it's very much a mischaracterization of the Black experience. And really, you know, as you and I both know, we're very highly educated, you know, and it just makes, it makes me, you know, feel like we need a PR makeover, right? Like when we talk about reproductive health, and even just the fact that you took the time to define what reproductive justice is, I think we really do need to do more public education. Because I feel like if more people understood what we went through on a day-to-day basis, there would be more apathy and maybe even empathy for the fact that, you know, women are dying and it's, mm-hmm. it's not necessary. And if anything, like you said, it's preventable. I know that, you know, one of the forums that we were at with the CMS administrator was talking about the implementation of having guaranteed Medicaid benefits after birth that were up to 12 months. And I believe at this point, and I might be slightly off with my numbers because there might be a few more states, but I think we're up to 46 states that now have that expansion. And I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I know that that was something that was part of the discussion when we were at that that forum.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is a major win for us, you know. So when we talk about all of the other things that are happening, you know, the fact that there is the reducing the quality of maternal care, you know, and are taking away our, you know, federal abortion protections. There are other wins, and that being the expansion of the Medicaid coverage, you know, postpartum to 12 months postpartum. Because when we look at the number of Black women that receive their coverage through Medicaid, it is pretty high. You know, that has an impact in a number of ways. Number one, since we're on the topic of abortion, if you receive your health care that's covered by Medicaid and you need to have access to abortion care, well, it's not covered by abortion care, by Medicaid. So that's why when we say just the right to an abortion is not enough for Black women, it's for that very reason, because if you can't access it, even though there's a law, then how is that a just law? That's why we use words like reproductive justice. And then, you know, we know that when we're talking about things like birth justice, which is an aspect of reproductive justice, you know, part of that is really leaning into the fact that we are our own experts. We are, you know, the best judges of our body and the things that we need. And so, you know, we were pushing for coverage, not only to extend the coverage, but also to allow coverage of things like traditional birth workers, like doulas, midwives, because those have proven, you know, that is before you also accurately talked about the history of the field of gynecology and how that came about. But for a very long time, we relied on midwives and these more traditional holistic approaches. And so we've lost a little bit of that in this process. So, you know, absolutely, we want to make sure that we are lifting up what we know works well to improve birth outcomes. And, you know, so the coverage is one piece of that, having to access traditional birth workers. But, you know, the things like the right to refuse unnecessary cesarean sections, the right to have your birth to respect it when you go into the hospital. You know, I came in there and I said, this is my birth plan. I hung it on the wall. Please do not keep asking me, do I want X, Y, and Z? Now, I had a unique situation, and so I had to pivot. But I can't tell you how many people say everything happened so fast, and the next thing I know, you know, it was totally different than what I wanted and what I requested, right?
Yeah. I mean, so, Serena Williams talks about this, right? Like one of the most successful Black women in America. And she talks about how she was forced to do things. And even with her husband trying to advocate for her, knowing that she'd had a history of a blood clot, And she was still like, had complications, and it actually impacted her professional career because she wasn't able to get back to tennis after her first child and then retired because she wanted to have a second child. And so I think, stories like that, the fact that she wrote about it, in Vogue, that's hugely important. To have those, symbols out there of people that are talking publicly about things that have happened to them. But the thing is one of the things that I've realized as I've started to talk about my own personal story is that it's not unusual. It's actually common. And it makes me like livid because it's like if somebody had told me these are the things that are possible, that you need to be able to stand up for yourself, that that things do happen so quickly during the birthing process, and that like your chances of having a birth-related issue are so much higher, I feel like I would have potentially sought care quicker because I was like, oh, I'm just tired. I have a toddler at home and a 7-week-old, and I just like, I just justified all of these things happening to me. And I feel like if somebody had said, you as a Black woman is so much more likely to have these complications, I feel like I would have been more on the like lookout for those things. And I think the fact that we don't talk publicly about the fact that this happens so frequently, is a problem. And I know for me personally, I blamed myself. I was like, there had to have been something that I did. It must have been the way that I spoke to the provider. I must not have like explained myself well. And so it took me years before I spoke about it publicly. And I feel like that alone, like the fact that we blame ourselves, is a product of the system because
Yeah, absolutely.
it's a product of the system.
Yeah, I mean, you have, and that's, I'm glad you picked up on this because that reminded me of another point you were making about, the narrative that has been told about us. We have this long history of trauma and reproductive oppression, that in Black communities that goes all the way back to slavery, right? So in order, we were responsible through breeding of keeping this economy growing and going. So in order to do that, we number one had to be dehumanized, and then there had to be a story created about us, right? There had to be a narrative about we're promiscuous or we're asking for it, right? And then when slavery was abolished and we still needed to continue, the workforce, then we became, well, not even then, we were always considered their property. But then we started passing laws saying that Black women couldn't be raped, right? So then we still have the continuation of that when we're not, when we come forward and say, I was assaulted, we're not believed. Because when you went to court, there's, studies about this, when, you just, that was not literally, you were considered that, then that's not possible, right? So you have those kind of stories and narratives. You have narratives about us being unfit. If you're thinking about eugenics and these notions of which population or groups should be able to have children and who should not, all of that requires a narrative that is not something that's created by us, right? And so when, even when you said, I thought it was something that I was doing, right? But I'm sure, you're somewhere in that encounter, the notion that you said, I didn't, maybe they thought I was pushing too hard or whatever. It's because you've had an experience where you felt, you know what, this is not a partnership, but I'm in the doctor's office, and this is not culturally sensitive, or certainly the best quality of care that I know I should be entitled to. The other piece of that is we don't believe in America in human rights. We believe in civil rights. We'll fight for the ability to sit at a lunch counter or whatever. But human rights is the belief that no matter who you are, race, creed, sexual orientation, gender, all that stuff, just by virtue of being born, you should have the same rights and the same access to the basic needs, human and general daily needs to be able to thrive. And we don't believe that as a country, that everybody should have equal access to that. So that's a major reason why we see these differences in the birth outcomes.
Ooh, just gave me the chills. Oh my goodness. It's heavy. It's heavy to talk about, but it needs to be spoken, and it needs to be spoken out loud, because for us to be able to fix a problem, we have to identify a problem. And if we don't talk about it, then we're never going to be able to even be able to move the needle at all.
And we can't keep relying on the system that created the system to fix the problem.
Well, and that's what people say all the time. Oh, the system is broken. And when I hear people say that, it like gives me the cringies, because I'm like, no, the system is working exactly the way it was meant to suppress and oppress, mm-hmm. right? Like specific members of society. So the system works for some, but it doesn't work for all. And that's because of the way that it was structured, and it was done that way on purpose.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to, you know, we have to really sit with that. You know, when I say things like, you know, a lot of this stuff is about power, you know, it seems like so simple. And when people say, no, you know, how can you simplify it to that, right? You know, maybe people don't sit up and want, you know, maniacal and say, oh, yes, how can I do all these things to make sure that I have power? But certainly what we do feel in certain populations is things like, you know, zero sum game, right? If I get this, if they get that, that means less for me.
Right.
Or, you know, and so it shows up in different ways, which usually reduces to, you know, one, the hierarchical, the need to maintain a hierarchy in our country. Yeah. And that essentially is power.
Wow. Well, I want to just pivot for a moment and chat a little bit about your book, because I know that that is something, you know, first and foremost, congratulations. That's a huge accomplishment. And just wanted to kind of touch a little bit about maybe what was your motivation for writing the book, obviously, as another public health professional. You know, I think these stories and narratives are extremely important, so that we can teach folks. But if you can maybe just chat a little bit about that, I think, and then, you know, I'll add in the show notes a link so that folks can check out the book as well.
Sure. So, you know, it was 2021. I was sitting at my desk and watching yet another webinar, you know, live stream about maternal mortality. And they said Black women are more likely to die. And I threw my hands up and I said, oh my God, if you say that one more time, I'm going to scream. I need you to say why. And so I really just got tired of hearing doctors, researchers, people like me, public health people, simplifying that to just a rate and a risk, right? You know, a lot of our research currently, well, until the last 10 to 15 years, has really been related to Black women's health interventions that focus on the bad things, right? You know, we're more likely to get chlamydia, more likely to get pregnant, all these other things, right? And what are the outcomes? But there was very few sex positive research, and certainly anything related to like sexuality and our, you know, having that in a positive light was not very present. So,
by the way, you know, he just released a report that our STI rates are going down. So just a little bit of good words on that.
Yes.
I haven't seen all of the ethnic and age breakdowns, but it's been going down in all categories. So syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. So I thought that was a nice, you know, bright spot in the news.
Recently.
So
that's great. I was excited to see that. And then, you know, as public health professionals, like our job is really to try to control for all the different factors that contribute to something. So we boil it down to, okay, we can say this is absolutely the cause of that, right? But we just talked about all those things, like the narratives and, all these external factors that contribute to these things. And so what I was trying to really do, honestly, was it was just a book that was a selfish gift to myself that, having my thinking evolved, right? I said, we can't really do this work if we only look at it from a scientific aspect only. We have to be able to incorporate these other disciplines in there, like, women's studies and, talking to people and focus groups and all these other things so we can get like those nuances, right? And so, I said, like, this is everything that I wish I would have learned, or people that I would have talked to when I was in public health school. And also going back to those people that said that thing that made me throw my hands up was like, okay, I just want to write a book so that you can have this on your desk. And so when you're talking about something, you can have this as a resource. So I basically called all of my smartest friends together and said, I want to write this book that's going to be kind of like a, reference book, or I call it like, you think about like Stevie Wonder's album, or like there's a certain albums that, from start to finish, there's certain songs you like, but you can literally play it from start to finish because there's little pieces in it anyway. So that's what this book is like. This each chapter can stand on its own, but if you start from the beginning and you read it to the end, you should be able to pick whatever part of the work you're doing in there and be more nuanced in it. So it tells that story when we were in slavery. It talks about all that stuff. It talks about Dr. Miriam Sims. It talks about, all of the horrific things that were being done to us so that we can have, Henrietta Lacks, all the things.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
it takes us all the way up to modern day. So when we, when we're talking about like, how do we do this work, right? So if you want to be a researcher, if you want to work in policy, if you want to work in, you want to start your own nonprofit. And the beautiful thing about this book, it is all contributed by Black women. It is for Black women. It is by Black women. So that point about, we can't keep relying on a system that created it to save us. But it's also because I knew that this work was out there and that this body of literature is growing, but it's not being promoted the way it needs to. It talks about, the Me Too movement. A lot of people don't know that that was started by a Black woman. A lot of the major movements in this country we've been at the center of them.
Even women's suffrage. We were fighting for right to vote, even though we knew we weren't going to get it.
Right. That's, there's another major scholar, Dr., Professor Michelle Goodwin, who says Black women are the canary in the coal mine, which basically means, that was the bird that was sent in there ahead of time. If it made it back, then that meant it was safe. If it didn't, then that means it was danger, right? And so basically Black women are that. Like oftentimes we are an early indicator of something that is wrong in our system, or certainly when things have broken down. So we are sent in, to sound the alarm, but also we sound the alarm, we rise up, we begin the resistance, but we often have to wait at the back of the line before we actually reap the benefits of it. So, whether that be voting, what it be, all of it, we've been there, and we often have to say, you go forward, even for our brothers, in the fight, they got to vote before we did. Right. And so like, what a gift that we keep giving to this country. And we have to do this often having experienced both sides of it, usually the oppression, until we finally get to the joy.
Oh, I couldn't have said it any more beautifully. Thank you so much. I feel like I've learned, even about my own history, and I thought I was pretty knowledgeable about these things, but I definitely, now I need to get a signed copy of your book next time I see you in person.
You know what? And I'm happy to do that. And actually, I would say, because my book now is going to have a new sleeve. Hopefully you will put the picture of the cover pop it into this thing, but it's intentionally. There was a story that I wanted to tell in that cover, and that, it's, multi-layered in that, there's image. Every time you look at it, I wanted you to notice something else. Like, as a Black woman in her crown, that, there's the red, gold, and the green, our beautiful silhouette of our stomach, the strength of our back. But also, I just found out, it was just announced earlier this week, that my book received the Choice Award, which is the American Libraries Association's award. It's over, they review over almost 4,000 books. And they choose, my book is in the top three. It's only the second public health book, I believe, at least for my publisher, that has received this award. And my book is one of the, maybe to one other book of its kind, that centers Black women's sexuality in a positive way. Yeah, so I'm really proud of it. And not just, I'm proud because it's, like I told you, it's contributed by these brilliant Black women, many of them who I have, loved their work, and that we could all bring it all together, so that not just other Black women who are doing this work have a resource, but those that consider themselves an ally. Like, if you are not going to be educated about this work, and you're not going to do what you need to do, and when you're using your place of privilege, I mean no offense, but we don't really need you in the fight if you're not going to be coming fully armed to this fight and there with us through the long haul.
Yeah, and I think wording it that way is very intentional, because it is a fight. We have to, unfortunately, we have to fight for everything. And you said it so beautifully, talking about just the strength of our resolve and our resilience. And I'm hopeful, and I'm looking towards the future with optimism, but it is going to be a fight, and we're going to have to speak up, and we're going to have to probably be exposed to some things that are uncomfortable, but I'm so grateful for you and what you do and your organization, because without that, we would not have a voice. And I'm so grateful for your time today, especially in our current climate of uncertainty, that you were able to take this time to discuss your work with me and with my audience. And I know that they will take a lot from it. So if folks want to reach out to you, know more about your organization or your foundation, where can they find more information?
Absolutely. So in our own voice, you can follow us across our socials at Black Women's RJ. That's Instagram, Facebook, X, Twitter, as well as LinkedIn. And then we also, our website is blackrj.org for In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda. And then for our action plan, it's Black RJ Action. And, I guess I would want to, if I had to give my parting thoughts, to just say, this is a time that is not, unfortunately, not unfamiliar to us. But we do what we do best, which is we rest, we strategize, and we get back out there. We remain unwavering in our resolve. We stand firm, and we're not afraid. This is, the playbook is to make us uncertain, make us feel uncertain, to make us want to course correct, to do all these things in anticipation of what someone might do. The reality is, they're probably going to do it regardless. So we might as well fight.
Yeah. So there's a question that I typically ask my guests at the end of the episode, and I know that I haven't prompted you for this. So if you don't have an answer, it's okay. I usually ask the question, if there was one thing you could tell your younger self, what would it be and why?
I would tell myself absolutely to give myself some grace that is not what is meant for me to experience, or the things that I'm meant to learn only come from being open and not trying to plot out everything and not trying to just control or decide what I think what is best for me, because my eyes would not have ever imagined, or I would not have conceived that I would be here. But it is the best decision that I've made, and it is certainly for a moment like this, I'm so proud to be doing this work.
Well, I am proud to know you, to admire you, and again, could not thank you enough for taking the time to record this podcast with me. Dr. Regina Davis Moss, you are a beacon of hope and light, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us today. Friendly reminder, again, this has been an episode of Public Health Matters, part of Pharmacy Times Pharmacy in Focus podcast series. I am your host, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the public health pharmacist. And remember, public health matters.